Hey, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the How to Become an Elite Financial Advisor podcast. I wanted to extend a personal invitation. If you had questions about coming to our How to Charge Live event in April of 2025, that you would go to howtocharge.live.com. That's howtocharge.live.com. Click on a button there that says schedule the call. And I'd love to answer any questions you have about coming to our event in April. It will sell out, but if you have questions, I want to answer them as quickly as possible so you can get your seat to that event. I look forward to seeing you here with us in April. And now, enjoy today's episode. Well, welcome everybody. I'm joined by my friend John Bass today. John, thanks for joining me and for sharing your story. We're going to specifically focus on a few parts of the business that I think that people universally have heard of, but I don't know that people on the outside who haven't experienced them still look at them with some mystery. And one of them is joint work. So I want to ask you first, how long have you been in the business? And then when did joint work become part of your path to success?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so very much, Andy, for having me on. So I've been in the business now for about 14 years. Joint work really at the beginning of my career was extremely important just because, you know, being in your low mid 20s, you just have a number of goals you have to overcome just based on having more of a baby face, needing to, work with people that are a different age group than you, more financially stable, having questions, how do I give them advice on something I may or may not have experienced? So joint work was the overall key to that, success. And I've kept on focusing and developing that kind of engagement through the rest of my career.
Give me some ideas of, people have heard of joint work. I think joint work can be, and people are always doing the math on, if I'm doing joint work, that means I'm splitting something that I'm already probably splitting with someone else, i.e. the company. So did you lean into joint work right away? How long did it take for you to really utilize and maximize that?
I would probably say, just within a handful of months of, the first time I had, a client say, John, how are you going to give me advice on something you haven't experienced? And that question kind of caught me off guard and made me start thinking of, how could I overcome that? Because obviously there were going to be other questions. At that point in my career, I hadn't had children yet, obviously hadn't retired. My parents were not experiencing health issues because I had younger parents that were only in their 40s at that point. When I went back and I said, okay, how can I address this or kind of pre-address concerns with clients? So I looked at a joint work partner, somebody that, could balance that out with me. And so I did a Google search and started saying, how do clients want to work with their financial advisor or financial planner? And there were a lot of common questions that were on there that, they were suggested that they ask. One of them was, should I be worried if my advisor will be retiring with me? And so I'm sitting there like, hey, that's the opposite problem of what I'm having, which is, I haven't experienced anything. So I kind of used some of that information that I had gathered and some of the questions I had presented to me from potential clients and reached out to some of my peers that actually might be experiencing a different kind of engagement issue as an individual advisor that I was having as well, but from a different perspective.
So did you ever use that as a way to get more business to say, hey, I'll be around when you retire?
Yes. Actually, I still use that today because you keep seeing a lot of those notes. I strongly suggest everyone, Google, especially with your zip code of, what do you expect from your financial advisor or planner? It's really interesting how many clients when they come meet somebody the first time, they go to the internet to figure out, or because they're uncomfortable with looking at full financial planning or looking at making a change, what questions do I have before I meet or interview with a new financial advisor? And that's one of the common ones. So I actually bring it up in the meetings. I kind of try to pre-address people's concerns.
So tell me some tips if people are going to do joint work. How much do you talk if you're if you bring the relationship, right, but you don't bring the expertise, how much do you just sit there and nod your head or how much do you actually engage? Does it change over time? Because there has to be some tension of, hey, you know, John, you're the one who brought me here, but you're not talking, right? You know, so give some people some tips on healthy joint work practices.
So obviously made mistakes at the beginning where, you know, I brought in that expertise or at least somebody that looked like the prospect. So I let them do more of the talking. As that's changed over time, and I realized that I had a really good partner, you know, at the beginning of my career that was like, hey, John, you need to talk a little bit more. And then so we started prepping for those meetings. Like, there's different values that we can add. There was things that I was extremely passionate about. Really, when I got into the career in the banking industry first, you know, was with Wachovia, who doesn't exist anymore. I was there through the 08 financial crisis. So I was very passionate about, you know, risk management, tax management. I remembered, you know, what happened to all of my peers when back then your 401k match was your employer stock. And nobody could have told us that, you know, a large institution like Wachovia was going to go under. And so that was a passion of mine. So one of my joint work partners was like, John, you're extremely passionate about that. You know, use that as part of the energy of the room to help articulate some of the value that we can offer them.
And you're passionate about it in light of the fact that it didn't work, right?
Yes. I mean, no one could have thought that you'd lose effectively half of your retirement account if that was your employer match. And then also, you know, eventually became part of Wells Fargo. It was a unique time, and that ended up, you know, affecting most of my career of being more of a risk manager because of that kind of situation. And then as time progressed, Andy, you know, now it's more of different things, the strengths that we can bring to the meeting. So when one of us isn't talking or engaging, we really kind of focus on the client's learning style. Because a lot of advisors teach verbally, but most Americans, learn visually. I think the last time I looked at it, and I got real passionate about this about 6 or 7 years ago, is it's like 2/3 of Americans learn visually, and only 1/3 of them learn verbally. And then you have a small slip that do, you know, kinesthetic learning or, you know, physically have to do something. And so I saw a huge disconnect there. So as my joint work partners and I developed, when one of us isn't talking, we were paying attention to, you know, how do the prospects and clients interact with us? Because most of the time, just like opposites attract, and, you know, between marriages, spouses tend to have different learning styles. And so if you tend to engage with one spouse that's a predominant verbal learner, and I want to teach verbally, and then that visual learner, you know, they're going to have a totally different engagement with us. And then if you happen to have a very unique kinesthetic learner, it's just a total disconnect. So that was one of the things we wanted to kind of tag team the type of engagement we did with those clients. We'd actually notate on our pads, or, you know, nowadays I use something a little more digital of like, this is how their learning styles are. This is how they take information the best. So when we would follow up with one spouse or both, we made sure that we did it in the way they took information in. This really helped us when you think of your original comment on like splits, or, you know, it costs you money to bring in a joint work partner. This actually increased our engagement rate. So we were getting a much, much higher closing precision than what we were before. And then our different passions and expertise plus engagement really helped us just keep on having higher and higher closing ratios and clients being more comfortable with us.
What are some signs of a good person to do joint work with? And what are some signs of someone you want to avoid? And then once you're in that situation where you're like, hey, this is not going to be a good joint work situation, do you just not call them again? I mean, how do you navigate that? So first, how do you find a good one? What's a good joint work partner?
It's somebody that has that, you know, thirst for knowledge and desire to teach, that it's not, I want to get to an answer immediately or quickly, that they want to do the proper diagnostic work before they give any kind of advice. Someone that's truly where their passion is. I think a number of people want to go a little quicker path because, you know, in general, that's how our industry is paid. But doing the more consistent, slow and methodical path is a much better engagement for those clients. So you want someone that aligns with those kind of values with you, because you need to make sure that comes across to your clients, because they can feel it if it's different. So you want to make sure from a joint work partner that you have those values and you have that honest conversation. In regards to not a good joint work partner, that transactional advisor, in general, that's where they want to focus. They want to get that, quick, sale done before they move on to anything else. Or somebody that, starts sitting there thinking too much in regards to how's the compensation going to be done, or you're always having to drag them to participate and engage like they were at the beginning. So they may be really good at the meetings, but they don't want to do any of the behind the scenes or any of the follow up or the additional due diligence. So someone that just keeps on aligning with your overall style and approach.
How much more successful do you think you were because you brought someone else along? I mean, do you think it would have taken you twice as long? Do you think you would have quit?
Yeah, I mean, without bringing someone along, especially when I left the bank channel to more of a 100% commission role, every one of those engagements were just so much more important. I would say, may not have even survived from the beginning of my career without working with somebody. No. Because a lot of it was that mental head crash, like y'all talk about a lot, where, as soon as I was getting, pushback from clients that how can you advise me on stuff I haven't experienced, it was getting in my own way of like, well, that's accurate. But then I had to sit there and, readjust and go, that could be in any kind of circumstance. It's not just age. And so that's where the joint work partner or someone with an additional expertise or passion that I did not have myself could bring in that additional benefit for me.
So let's talk about the progression of your business. Joint work was a big part of it. And remind me again, how many years you've been in the business?
About 14.
Okay. So how is your business changed and developed into as you now are part of, the things we teach here and been a part of several of our events, as it relates to financial planning?
Sure. So, over the years, I did a lot of financial planning, but did not charge for it. It was one of my things where I felt like I was being compensated fairly enough from the implementation of those solutions for the client. Just a mental hurdle of hard to overcome of charging for that advice. So as time went by, and actually, my manager today that I've been with for 10 years, pretty much every one of our meetings for, every single week when we would talk, would be like, hey, John, you're not, valuing yourself for what you are bringing to the table. It creates a different type of engagement. Sometimes people feel like if something's free, they're not getting true value. You're getting exactly what you paid for. So separating it into two different engagements from like, this is your planning, the plan. This is the approach we're going to implement in order to meet your long-term success. Yeah. And then doing implementation as a separate phase has been just unbelievably significant. I would say now, a lot of the clients we're dealing with only want to go through planning, and they're actually questioning themselves, why haven't I gone through a, fee-based plan before? Because they kind of have a collection of one-off products or solutions, and there's no, actual strategy implemented with them that they collected over the years. And so when they see that coordination, and they see somebody looking on the efficiencies, inefficiencies they have, making it more efficient, be more purposeful and tactical with their actual resources, they're seeing that huge impact. And, we have that conversation where we go, hey, if your advisor is focusing mostly on asset management or insurance or just retirement, then mostly that is what they see. But how do I know the correct, investment advice if we're not looking at your cash flow? Your tax situation, what your actual purposes and goals for it. So doing all that due diligence as a separate engagement, it just makes them feel much more comfortable with moving forward with recommendations and implementation. I've been doing fee-based planning now for about 3 years and really ramped it up under, y'all's tutelage over the last, year and a half, 2 years. And I would say there hasn't been a client that hasn't moved forward with implementation in that entire time planning when they've gone through fee-based planning. So it's had a significant impact. Whereas all before, as I wasn't charging, people would question. They'd be like, okay, if you're not charging me, then you're obviously doing it, even though you're not saying it out loud. to make income from whatever the implementation is. I feel like there might be a conflict or bias there. And so that a couple times that had been brought up to me over my career, and obviously I was trying to say, you know, dissuade them and everything else. That's not the intent. Now I don't have that conversation anymore, and they just feel so much more appreciative of the type of engagement we're doing.
I think that that can be unbelievable to some people who are having a hard time selling planning, because and I was literally just emailing with a member of our community today who had presented a plan, and he said, you know, this gentleman he presented it to, he said he responded in sort of a sticker shock sort of way, because he said, I don't think they were just anticipating. And there was a $3,500 fee, I think it was their minimum, but the prospect was just like, nope, not interested in that. So from a really practical perspective, what are the things that you're doing that you think make it easier for people to say yes, make it so it's, you know, you're more confident in your presentation? On a really practical level, what would you say to someone that is saying, hey, you know, John, I want to do this stuff and I'm trying to do it, but people aren't saying yes. What advice would you have for them?
I think step number one is being so confident in your meeting one with a new prospect, exactly what your process is going to be. Not having a long 10-15 minute personal introduction situation. You're there to have a professional engagement. I've never gone to a doctor or an attorney that wanted to tell me about their personal life for 15 minutes. It might be some pleasantries at the beginning, but effectively we're there to do business and have a conversation. Then getting into, your articulable value, how you work and engage with clients, how you're different. I kind of think of it as more of like almost like an offensive language situation, where you talk about, a lot of our industry focuses on, asset management, retirement planning, or insurance planning. I truly believe, looking at holistic advice, that your entire financial situation needs to be reviewed, and then you can give some examples. It's a great opportunity for your first, whiteboarding engagement. Let me show you something. One of the things I love doing in North Carolina, because you don't need a high income to be middle class here, is one of the illustrations I do is I like showing, hey, if you're getting $60,000 a year from an IRA, $30,000 a year for, both you and your spouse from Social Security, you're making $120,000 a year. Let's say, God forbid, something happened to one of the spouses. What happens to your Social Security? And they'll interact with me and they'll go, hey, that means we lose, one of the Social Securities in the circumstances of the same amount. It's like, okay, yeah, your income now has dropped down to $90,000. What if I told you that, when your spouse, more than likely your wife, is grieving of losing the love of her life, going through that emotional trauma, she just lost $2,500 a month in income, that she's going to pay a little over $1,200 more in federal taxes than she did when y'all were making $120,000. And this gets, now all of a sudden that grabs the attention of the other spouse, because they don't, want to leave their love for their life in that situation. And then I'll stack it and I'll go into, this is how our bucket system works. 10, 12, 22, these are your thresholds. And I say, you think it's bad now, wait until 2026 if the current tax codes expire. Here's 15 and 25% instead of 12 and 25, standard deduction getting cut in half. And I said, it's not just about the rate of return. It's not just about, life insurance risk management. It's also, what is your spouse going to keep? And so we've changed the engagement significantly at that point. We've had an emotional connection, in that circumstance. They're understanding that it's not just what rate of return am I aiming for, it's what's the purpose of the money that I have. That's usually my first opportunity in that meeting one. Then we go a little bit deeper into, how do we work with clients? I'm really wanting to be your idea partner. My value is not the products and solutions I sell, it's the advice. Yeah. And how do we make sure that we're purposeful with what you're trying to accomplish? And so that meeting one, where you can have it so regimented, where you're not having to think about it so much, you then can change into, engaging with their learning styles. Now all of a sudden you're not having to think about what you're talking about. You know what you're going to talk about in meeting one. So you can adjust your language or your next, one or two whiteboards, because I try to do two or three in each meeting, to be much more purposeful for what the client is looking for, because you spend that time to be able to read and engage with them. So now when they leave and they talk about you in the car afterwards, they feel completely different. Now, obviously, after meeting one, it kind of goes wherever it needs to go, because every client is a little bit different. Every household and business is a little bit different. Right. But having that regimented meeting one really allows you to confidently keep on getting better. You can't keep tweaking your language. You can't tweak the types of styles and whiteboarding that you do, and you know where your flow of your meeting is going, if you don't know where you want to go in that.
Now, what are some other things you like to whiteboard?
Right now, tax strategies is one of my favorite. It's been going on for like 7 or 8 months now on a run. And then also like looking at, we have a lot of, church givers here in the South, a lot of us tithe, 10%, or significant amount of our income. So using our IRA or using the required minimum distributions to go straight to our church instead of flowing through the IRS has a huge impact. It makes hilarious conversations. Because you're sitting there and you go, hey, I know you give about $1,000 a month to the church. We're going to have to true that 12 grand up to 16 after we pay taxes, the net that 12. How about we cut out the IRS and just give more to your church? That has a significant impact. Every now and then people laugh and be like, well, do I have to tell the pastor it saved me taxes? No, you don't have to do that. You're welcome to true it up to 16 if you want to. But yeah, it just changes the flow, because a lot of the advice they've gotten in the past is not about concepts. It's about things that make the advisor money. So it just makes the engagement much more fun. And so looking at taxes, looking at, giving more to your church or charity, those have been some of my more fun and passionate ones in the first meeting.
Give me, if you would, an example of one of the tax strategies you like to talk about beyond that giving one. Is there anything else that you try to bring up regularly, even if it's simple?
Sure. One of the more simple ones is, deciding when you want to pay taxes. Maybe it's just in my area, but I feel like the vast majority of American wealth tends to be in pre-tax, 401ks and IRAs. I just had a financial plan I was working on that I'm delivering this afternoon, actually. He's got about $3.9 million, and all of his money, except for $19,000, is pre-tax IRA. He's 59 years old. And so one of those things I do is, the IRS says you eventually will have to pay taxes. We can control the when, where, and how. Right. And one of the things that you can do is, filling up your tax bucket on a yearly basis. Every year, get together and say, what are you comfortable with and paying on your effective tax rate? Or you could do a bucket strategy as well, instead of leaving yourself kind of hostage effectively to when the IRS makes you, then you're kind of stuck.
Right. So again, that would be a 3-bucket strategy, and helping people understand you want to have options. Because at certain times, because we don't know the future, it's better to have options, right? Let's leave that bucket alone, because it's not good to use right now because of, whoever's in office or the way the economies have been, or, whatever income you had that year, whatever it might be. So that's helpful. That's helpful. Well, let me ask you this as we wrap up. What are you excited about in the next 2 to 3 years for you, your team, your growth?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I'm extremely excited about is, keep on expanding the team. We're getting into more of, business-based financial planning. We're seeing, as state taxes might be changing when the current sunset cap happens in 2026, that it's very easy for people that have just kind of accidentally accumulated properties, their business has appreciated over the years, to all of a sudden just have, issues of what they thought they were going to leave as a legacy to their children. Getting into some of that situation where there's a coordination of all the different assets they have from personal and business side, and making sure it flows exactly how they're expecting it to and intended to. One of the things, side effects of inflation, is some of these property values for a number of people that have accumulated rental properties, it keeps going up. And so those values keep on growing, causing further and further tax consequences as their net worth goes up. Yeah. And I think everyone's taken a lifetime to accumulate this net worth. We don't want to give it away just to somebody else for a lack of efficiency. So that's also helping us get bigger planning fees. Some of the proposals that we've looked at, recently have been in the $10,000 to $15,000 range. Because the business owners, it's just a much different conversation they're used to having a cost for doing business. Yeah. And when they see those quick ideas, they're like, this is great. So the next 2 or 3 years, really getting in that space, you know, so much more, it has been very fun and exciting and enjoyable. And it's expanding my knowledge base as well, because the more stuff you run into, real life is so different from the book world. So it's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Well, and we're recording this in the middle of 2024, and I'm going to remind folks that we've got a brand new option for folks who want to get better at that kind of whiteboarding called Whiteboarding University. So keep an ear out and an eye out for that as we continue to develop our teaching around that. We've had that as part of our How to Charge Live training, but we're separating it, diving even deeper, and we'll have multiple sessions of Whiteboard University for people to understand the framework, the language. You know, I like to say language instead of scripting, because scripting is, you know, you got to follow the script, but language you can use in a more fluid way. And so we want to give folks a framework for how to talk about and do whiteboarding in an effective way. And you've done that, and you've done it with success, and so has your team. I want to thank you for talking about whiteboarding, talking about adding planning to your business, and also the power of teaming with other people and doing joint work. I know it's been practical and helpful for those who have listened. So thanks for your time, John. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Annie. I appreciate it as well.
Hey, thanks for listening to that episode. I want to invite you to tune into episode 167 that we'll be releasing in February of 2025. It specifically interviews three different advisors about their experience adding planning or improving their planning business based on the things that we teach at our live event and in our coaching program. And the reason I think that you're going to really enjoy it is because it's advisors with different amounts of experience implementing planning in different ways, who all paid their own money, their own investment to come and to get trained or coached by us. And I think you'll be encouraged to hear about how they implemented what they learned. And I hope, and Sten and I, we both hope that you'll consider joining us at our in-person event in April of 2025, because that really is where we find advisors who take the time to step out of their day-to-day life, who then go home and implement what we teach, that they find the most success. And that's what we want for you, to become an elite advisor. And so please check out that episode 167. And as always, thanks for listening.